2. Svetlana pushed her way through the crush of people until she spotted Parry. At the last rotation, there were 145 souls on the ship, most of whom had gathered to hear Bella's announcement. They were plastered around the inside wall of the cylindrical gymnasium, tethered in place with hooks and Velcro and gecko flex and the friction of body on body. The gym, which doubled as a commons and radiation storm shelter, was normally spun to provide centrifugal gravity, but that would have kept Bella from floating into the middle to address the crowd. "I'm sorry about," Parry began hesitantly when Svetlana reached him. "You know, that little thing earlier. I guess you didn't need me giving you a hard time on top of everything else."
"No, not today."
"It's just that we badly wanted to play with our comet, babe."
"Boys will be boys, I suppose."
She gave him a quick squeeze, letting him know it was all right. "All ancient history now, though."
"So Bella tells me. Any idea what this is all about?"
Parry's concerned expression softened. He knew he was off the hook for now at least. "Didn't get a chance to check Shipnet. Was there..."
"Nothing. No CNN, no space.com, no nothing. Guess Bella pulled them."
"That's what I figured. The football fans weren't happy, I can tell you."
Svetlana tried to look concerned. "They weren't?"
"Bella pulled the plug on the Kiev game halfway through the shootout."
"The poor darlings."
Parry scratched his mustache, looking endearingly puzzled. He was a short, stocky man with an open, friendly face, clean-shaven, saved for the mustache, with a thatch of unruly black hair bursting from underneath his knitted red diver's cap. "You think something's happened there?" he wondered. "An accident? Something like that?"
"Don't think so. I pulled up a system map. We're on the other side of the sun from Saturn, so Earth and Jupiter are a lot closer. Red could get a ship to Saturn quicker than we could."
"Clever girl."
"That's all I've got. I think Bella would have opened up more if Terrier Boy hadn't been there with her."
"Maybe we should leave the little shit behind on the comet," Parry said, voice low. "You know, send him out on an errand. Say someone left some paperwork behind, then forget to pick him up.
Unfair to microorganisms, though. The complex molecules might get upset."
"Good point, babe. Wouldn't want to offend those poor unsuspecting pyramidines, would we?"
"Absolutely not. Even pyramidines have feelings."
Parry looked up as a hush fell across the gymnasium. "Here we go. Guess we're about to find out what's got the little lady in such a tiz." Bella coughed. "Thanks for your attention," she said. The pumps had been turned off ahead of schedule, so that she could be heard without having to shout. "I'll keep this brief, since we'll have a lot to discuss." Floating free at the core of the gymnasium, Bella had her arms folded and one leg tucked behind the other. By accident or design, she had retained a slow residual spin so that she faced everyone in the room once a minute. 11 hours ago," Bella continued, "I received a message from headquarters. The message was, to say the very least, startling. Even more startling was the request that followed. I've had half a day to digest this information, and I'm still only starting to get my head around it. I'm afraid the rest of you have even less time." Somehow, amongst all the people crammed into the room, Bella managed to spot Svetlana. She made brief eye contact, nodding her head so slightly that the gesture would have been imperceptible to anyone else. "Once I heard the news," she went on, "I took an unprecedented step. As some of you will have already realized, I blocked all outside news from Shipnet. I didn't do this lightly, but please believe it was necessary. Shortly after the initial announcement, it became clear the networks were contributing nothing useful to the discussion, and what we need now is clarity, absolute clarity, because we have a very difficult decision to make." As Bella paused, Svetlana looked around, picking out faces. Tethered near her were Chieko, Yamada, and Carsten Flaig from her own flight operations team, lovers who went everywhere together. A little further around the curve of the gym was Joseph Protsenko, who, despite looking like a potato farmer, was one of the best mass driver specialists in the business. There was Rika Bettendorf from EVA Ops, one of the three people responsible for checking out suit safety and making sure people didn't black out because of malfs in the air trimix. There was Judy Sugimoto from the medical section. She'd taken off her glasses and was rubbing away a smear on one lens against the collar of her smock.
There was Tom Crabtree, the taphead, standing alone and isolated, as always. None of them looked as if they were in on any secrets. Svetlana turned her attention back to Bella, who was speaking again. "I've talked to my technical team," Bella was saying, "and they tell me what we're being asked to do is feasible. Risky, but feasible. But so is everything we do." Bella closed her eyes, as if she couldn't quite remember the next line in her script, then took a breath and went on. "Now we get to the difficult part. It concerns Janus, one of Saturn's moons." Svetlana allowed herself a small guilty flicker of pride. She'd figured that much out, at least. "Or rather," Bella interrupted Svetlana's thoughts, "Janus used to be one of Saturn's moons. Now we have to redefine it. About 30 hours ago, Janus's orbit began to deviate from its expected trajectory around Saturn." People started talking. They couldn't help it. Bella held up a hand and waited for silence. "Janus stopped orbiting Saturn," she said, "and broke away, following what was initially a very sharp course towards ecliptic south, out of the plane of the planets. That didn't last long, though. After 12 hours, Janus changed direction again, this time turning in the rough direction of Jupiter. The course it's following is strictly non-Keplerian, which means it isn't showing any signs of being influenced by the gravitational fields of the Sun or the other planets. All the same, the specialists say they have a good handle on it mathematically. It will miss Jupiter by slightly less than 1 AU. Assuming that nothing happens during its Jupiter approach, the moon will cross to the other side of the system. By then it'll be headed out of the ecliptic plane at 11 degrees south, in the direction of the constellation Virgo." Bella paused to draw breath, as if even she were having difficulty believing her own words. "Ladies and gentlemen," she continued, "Janus is accelerating. It's managing around 1/4 of a G. There was no sign of any encounter with another massive body, nor of any natural outgassing mechanism that could even begin to explain such behavior. The simple fact is that it very much looks as if Janus was never a moon in the first place." "A ship," Svetlana said under her breath, along with about half the room. Parry's hand tightened around hers. Whatever had happened to sour things between them in the last day was over now, erased into insignificance by this astonishing news. Bella responded to their murmured speculation. "Yes," she said, "that does appear to be what we're dealing with. It even looks as if the icy surface is starting to peel off in wisps, like camouflage. If that continues, we might begin to see what's really underneath." She smiled at them all. "There's a problem, though. Janus is getting further and further away, so the view isn't getting any better."
"Oh, no," Svetlana said.
"There's only one ship in the system in anything like the right position to intercept and shadow Janus on its way out. No prizes for guessing which ship I'm talking about. The plan is we put the pedal to the metal for 3 weeks. At 0.5 G we can meet Janus and still have enough fuel left to shadow it for 5 days. Then we turn tail and head back home." Bella said nothing for another slow rotation of her body, allowing the commons to erupt into noisy questions before speaking again. "It's up to us," she said, raising her voice until the clamor died down. "No other ship in the system, manned or otherwise, can do this." Parry raised his voice. People respected Parry Boyce. They fell silent to let him speak. "This isn't in our contracts, Bella. Actually, there is a clause that covers additional non-specified activities," Bella said, "but that doesn't mean there won't be compensations. Triple our usual danger bonus, from the moment we commit to chasing Janus until the moment we dock back around Mars, with discretionary rewards on top of that, depending on the conditions near Janus." She waited a beat before adding, "That's a shitload of money, people." "Triple our usual danger bonus," Parry repeated. "That's the deal. I'll buy a nice headstone." Bella let them have their laughter. "Parry's right to mention the danger," she said, when the room had simmered down. "That's why this isn't something I'm going to enforce without a clear mandate. I'm giving you all 1 hour to think this over. In 1 hour, report individually to your section chiefs. In 90 minutes, the section chiefs will report to me. Based on their findings, I'll make my decision." Bella spread her hands. "I wish I could give you more information. I can't. There isn't any. I wish I could give you more time, but there isn't any of that either. The fuel situation is tight. Bella acknowledged Svetlana again. She had timed the remark with her usual care. 1 hour, she said. I'm sorry there's no other way of doing this. Bella grabbed a nylon line stretching across the room and began to haul herself towards the wall of the commons. Then she paused and looked back at the gathering. Oh, before I forget, since I know some of you are dying to find out. It went to Dynamo Kiev, on penalties. Some impulse made Ryan Axford pause on his way to the patient's bedside. He picked up his flexi from his desk and called up the most recent tomograph of Jim Chisholm's skull. He stroked his finger against the false color image, rotating it so that the intricate three-dimensional structures became clear. The inside of his patient's skull was now as familiar to Axford as the architecture of his own house, far away on Albemarle Sound. He knew its passages and alcoves, its attic and cellar, its concealed chambers, its cavities, cracks and floors. He knew its secret monsters. He had already looked at the scans with a clear clinical eye, and he knew that he had missed nothing. The disease was already progressing along textbook lines, diffuse infiltration of contiguous and regional structures of the central nervous system, compression, invasion, and destruction of neighboring brain parenchyma. It was irrational to expect the images to have changed, yet he could not resist examining them one more time, hoping that he had indeed neglected some detail, a hint of shrinkage. Axford dimmed the flexi and placed it gently back on his desk. Nothing had changed. Nothing could have changed. He caught Gail Simmons, the duty nurse, leaving Chisholm's curtained-off bedside. She held a blood-filled syringe tipped with a plastic safety cap, a saline bag clutched in her other hand. "How's our guest?" he asked. "Comfortable," she said, her southern drawl, with its questioning upwards lilt, elongating the word. Simmons was young and keen, transferred into deep shaft from Northside Hospital, Atlanta. She wore her black hair long and was popular with the other men. Axford touched her sleeve and lowered his voice. "Any thoughts about what Bella just told us, Gail?"
"Whatever's best for the patient, I'm cool with that."
Axford nodded and peered into her eyes, searching for a clue to her real feelings. She blinked and looked away. "That's what I was thinking too," he said. Chisholm was listening to Charles Mingus playing "Goodbye Pork Pie Hat." Axford lowered the music to a murmur as he entered the screened-off area. Chisholm's expression was neutral, neither welcoming nor shunning his visitor. He knew that Axford could be the bearer of the worst kind of news as well as the best. "Bella talked to me," Axford said. "She wanted to make sure you had all the facts."
"She didn't talk to me," Chisholm said.
Axford sat down next to the bed. Bella was concerned that you'd feel persuaded against your own judgment if she spoke to you in person. Jim Chisholm blinked and squinted upwards, as if taking an interest in something on the ceiling. The light in the room was low, green-tinged and calculatedly soothing. Around the bed, machines ticked and hummed and bleeped in an endless, numbing chorus. Chisholm reached for a glass of water.
"Did Bella ask you anything?"
"Yes," Axford said. "She did. She wanted all the facts at her disposal."
"What did you tell her?"
"The truth, or at least my understanding of it."
"Which was?"
Axford chose his words with care.
"You have a progressive condition that, untreated, stands a good chance of killing you within 3 months." "I know this."
"I still think it's worth spelling things out. I can't cure you, and I can't stop the disease from advancing. I can relieve the intracranial pressure. I can administer anticonvulsants. I can try to stabilize your neurotransmitter and cytokine levels, but the best I can do is slow things down. Short of..." Axford caught himself before he went on. "Realistically, your only hope of survival is to return to Earth within 3 months. Sooner would be better, obviously."
"I know this," Chisholm said again.
"But I need to know that you know it." Axford leaned closer to him, lowering his voice. "Here's the deal. When you signed up for this mission, you accepted certain medical risks. We all did. We have to accept that it simply isn't practical to carry a hospital's worth of state-of-the-art surgical equipment, let alone the expertise to use it on board a ship. That's why we go through such intensive medical screening before they let us aboard. but there is always a statistical risk of something getting past those tests.
Where's this heading?
If I could have arranged a shuttle to take you home, I would have. Failing that, I have to look at the quickest way to get you back, given the options currently on the table.
Go on,
Chisholm said. Bella's polling the crew. If the answer that comes back is no, we'll simply resume normal operations. We'd do another crew rotation shuttle in 5 months. I'm pushing them to send that ship out earlier, but I doubt that they'll be able to shave more than 4 or 6 weeks off the schedule. Chisholm looked at him. His eyes narrowed.
Back there, you almost said something. Short of, you began, and then you stopped.
Short of what, exactly? I shouldn't have said anything. I don't agree with it.
Don't agree with what?
The company has a contingency plan, Axford said reluctantly, for cases like yours where the prognosis is poor and where there is no prospect of an early return to Earth. It's called Frost Angel.
Frost Angel. No one's ever mentioned anything called Frost Angel to me.
It isn't widely discussed outside the medical section. It's something we hoped never to have to put into practice.
You have no idea how encouraging that sounds.
The contingency is... Axford hesitated, momentarily unable to continue. He had never expected to find himself talking to Jim Chisholm like this. Chisholm was still his effective superior, Bella Lynn's second in command. What business did the company have in not telling Chisholm about something like this through formal channels?
Ryan,
Chisholm prompted. Axford steeled himself and said, "The idea is that we kill you now. It'd be a controlled, painless transition into unconsciousness. Once you're unconscious, there are a couple of options open to me to complete the euthanization. After inducing cardiac arrest, I'd proceed with a rapid exsanguination, flushing out your blood and replacing it with a cold saline solution. The object is to get as much oxygen out of your body as possible. Oxygen is the engine that causes ischemic damage if your heart stops pumping, so the less of it we leave in you, the better. That's one option."
"I'm just dying to hear the other one," Chisholm said.
"Instead of the saline flush, we keep the heart running and expose you to an atmosphere containing a high concentration of hydrogen sulfide, around 80 parts per million. After a few minutes, respiration will slow and your core body temperature will plummet. The hydrogen sulfide molecules will start binding to the same cell sites that oxygen normally uses, so, in effect, we lock oxygen out of the loop. It achieves more or less the same result as the saline flush." Axford waited for that to sink in. He looked at Chisholm's smooth, untroubled face and read nothing.
"Maybe I'm missing something," Chisholm said, "but in either scenario, wouldn't I still be dead at the end of it?"
"Dead, yes, but protected from ischemic damage. That's the point of Frost Angel. The damage doesn't get any worse."
"And then, when we make it home, they'll bring me back?"
"They'll try their best."
"How many people have been through this?"
"As part of the official Frost Angel program? Not as many as I'd like."
"Meaning none, right, Ryan?"
"I'm not sugaring any pills here. The way things are going, in 10 years, 15 years, they might be able to bring you back. Then again, they might not."
"I don't get this. You're saying you can shut me down, but you can't operate on my brain?"
"The process isn't complicated. It's, how shall I put this, within the scope of the services we're set up to provide."
"You mean you'd be running that saline flush through me no matter what happens?"
"Frost Angel means doing it before the damage becomes extensive." Chisholm stared off into the distance for a few uncomfortable moments as Mingus played on.
"You think this is a good idea?"
"I accept the medical logic, given the situation. That doesn't mean I'm jumping for joy at the idea of going ahead with it. It would depend on the severity of the condition and on the odds of reaching home in time." Still torn, Axford paused. "If you wanted it, that doesn't mean I wouldn't oblige. I'd need your consent. Otherwise, it's murder. I could get into serious trouble for that."
"And we wouldn't want that."
"But maybe we don't have to freeze you," Axford said. "Maybe there's still a way to get you back in time." Chisholm nodded shrewdly, like someone who had just got the punchline of a joke.
"Janus, right?"
"My professional recommendation," Axford said, "is that you vote for the mission. I've spoken to Bella. When we've completed the Janus rendezvous, we'll return home on the fastest possible trajectory. We may even be able to meet the shuttle halfway. Even if we can't, I still think we can get you home in 7 or 8 weeks.
Is that soon enough?
When we get back home, Axford said, everyone will want a piece of us. And when they find out there's a sick man aboard, every nation on the planet will be fighting for the privilege of treating you. Chisholm closed his eyes and slumped back against his pillow. Barely audible above the machines, Mingus had moved on to Open Letter to Duke. For a moment, the two of them listened to the music, as if somewhere within it there might be an answer neither of them had so far imagined, an option that involved neither freezing nor a risky encounter with something alien.
They've never brought anyone back, have they?
They're getting better all the time. They're up to mammals now. They did a rabbit last year. As the car slid along Rock Hopper's spine, Bella unzipped her jacket and removed the flexi that had been recharging itself from her body heat. A deft flick of her wrist stiffened the sheet of leathery plastic. The shipnet menu formed in its iridophores, tinged with a blue-green cast where some of the flexi's living cells were beginning to die. Bella navigated to her private area and retrieved the latest message from Powell Kagan. He sat in a living room, its surfaces gleaming with reflected moonlight. Bella heard the faint roar of what she first took to be road traffic, but then realized must be ocean breakers. She thought she recognized the room, one of the framed prints on the wall, a reproduction of one of Kagan's favorite new metal album covers looked familiar to her. Across 25 years, she could almost place the villa and the island. Kagan never changed much. His white hair was still spiked and gelled in the manner of his youth. He wore a black shirt unbuttoned at the collar, with a pale sweater draped over his shoulders, sleeves tied together across his chest. He was nearing his 80th birthday, but he could have passed for a retired tennis pro in his late 50s, holding down a good game and a good med program.
"Hello, Bella," he said. "Excuse the interruption, but it appears we'll need to move faster than we expected. The Chinese are further ahead than we thought."
He held up a hard copy of China Daily. The paper cast a pallid glow across his desk.
"They're talking about their own unilateral expedition. They say they've got a crew together and that they're ready for engine start-up. More than likely it'll blow up in their faces, but we have to be ready in case it doesn't. I've spoken to Inga, and, although she clearly can't go on the record about this, she agrees with me."
He said Inga with such affected casualness that it took Bella a moment to realize that he meant Inga de Jong, the Secretary General of the United Economic Entities. He shifted in his chair as the roar of surf rose like static.
"A lot of water has passed under our mutual bridges, but I've never doubted your strengths. If, when, you have that yes vote, you can move on it immediately. There's no need to wait for my confirmation before you begin the chase."
His excellent teeth flashed silver in the moonlit room. "Good luck, Bella. For old time's sake.
All right?"
She smiled at that, not because it pleased her, but because she found it amusing that Kagan still expected her to look back on their affair with something like fondness. The depth of his lack of understanding was awesome, even after 25 years. The image faded. Bella softened the flexi and slipped it back under her zip-up. The car slowed as it neared the mid-spine machine shop and slid into a reception dock. Bella climbed out and hand-propelled herself through access corridors reeking of lubricant and ozone. In addition to Craig Schrope, there were 7 chiefs present. Some of them floated. Some had lashed themselves to floor or wall with tie lines, Velcro or Geckoflex, while others lounged on or straddled the outstretched manipulator arms of the deactivated robots. Bella centered herself, taking time to make careful eye contact with everyone in the room.
"Thank you for getting here on time," she said.
"Has anything changed in the last 90 minutes? Asked Svetlana.
"Not to my knowledge," Bella said, "although it's becoming increasingly difficult to pick out signal from noise where the news is concerned."
"Janus still doing its thing?"
"Yes."
"I'd like numbers for its trajectory," Svetlana said.
"Now," said Schrope softly.
She looked at him.
"It can wait until we're underway."
"Well, let's not jump the gun," Bella said. "We may decide we're not going anywhere.
or have you reached a collective decision while you were waiting for me? The team chiefs glanced at each other, but no one volunteered to speak for the group. Bella looked at Parry Boyce. His people were the workers who actually had to crawl into Comets, taking core samples and figuring out the best way to anchor the unwieldy mass driver if a comet turned out to be worth steering home. They were tough. They formed the largest and most volatile element of the crew. Beneath his red diver's cap, Parry's open and friendly face gave nothing away.
"Well?" she asked.
"I've a small majority in favor of chasing Janus," he said, "split down aquatic and orbital lines with a narrow win for the orbitals.
What do you think?"
"I think we should do it. I think it's madness, but I still think we should do it."
"You had high hopes for this comet," Bella said.
"There'll be others. There may never be another Janus." She thought Parry was done, his verdict delivered. But after a moment he spoke again. "We still want guarantees. We want that triple bonus agreement in writing. We want it paid even if something prevents us from catching up with Janus."
"We'll have to be underway before I have any of that confirmed," Bella said.
"Fine, but if we don't like the terms when they're rubber-stamped, we turn the ship around."
"Acceptable to me," Bella said, before Shrope could contradict her.
"That means no company horseshit in the small print."
"Fine. Anything else?"
"Just a bit." He handed her his own flexi. Bella stared at the numbers Parry had blocked in. A sliding scale of danger terms, linked to proximity to Janus, far exceeding the bonus she had offered in the gymnasium. "It's all non-negotiable," he added. Wordlessly, Bella passed the flexi to Shrope, who glanced down at it and pulled a sour expression.
"You're talking about terms that will bankrupt the company."
"It's the company's call," Parry said easily. "If they feel Janus is worth our time, they'd better be ready to pay for it."
"If you bankrupt the company, you won't have jobs to go back to when we get home," Shrope said.
"The idea is that we won't need jobs," Parry said. Bella scraped grit from her eyes.
"You should listen to Craig," she said.
"This isn't only about the company. We just happen to be the one ship with a chance of doing this. The fact that there's a company logo on the side doesn't matter. We're representatives of the entire human species." Parry laughed at her. They all laughed at her. She felt like a child in a room full of adults, coming out with something naive and touching.
"I'm serious,"
she said, feeling her cheeks redden. Parry shrugged.
"So are we. Deadly bloody serious."
"Parry did the sums," said Denise Nadis, the head of mass driver operations. "In accountancy terms, we're still a blip. No one's coming out of this bankrupt." Bella sighed, knowing there was no point fighting this one. She looked around at all the other chiefs.
"Let's hear your piece, Denise."
Nadis leaned forward on the robot arm she had picked for a support. She was 31, a small, intense black woman with long purple fingernails that she somehow managed to keep intact, despite being one of the best teleoperators on the ship. She had a nose stud, eyebrow ring, and tribal tattoos, worn as a tribute to her late grandmother.
"My people overwhelmingly say no," she said. "We push ice. It's what we do. What we came here to do. But if we have to accept, if the final result is yes, then we'll expect the same terms that Parry's proposing."
Bella turned to the bald man sitting next to Nadis, Nick Thale, the unassuming head of remote cometary geoscience. Thale's small but dedicated team used remote sensing techniques, radar, lasers, spectroscopy, to survey comets from a distance of many light seconds.
"We say go for it," he said. "My team would actually kill for the chance to turn their expertise onto something other than another dirty snowball. If you can get us close to Janus, we're confident that we can do some real science for once."
"Good,"
Bella said.
"We do, however, want a modifier to Parry's terms."
Thale glanced at the other men. "In general, we find the terms he's suggesting acceptable. Our quibble is with the clause for surface conditions. As soon as surface operations commence, we demand that everyone is paid at the same rate, irrespective of whether they're in a suit or not."
"You call that a quibble?" Bella said.
"As Denise pointed out," Thale said, "no one's going to lose any money over this."
"I don't like it," Parry said, turning to the other men. "Nick, I know your people are good at their work, but it won't be any of your guys sweating in a fucked-up Orlan 19 when we reach Janus.
Those are the conditions you work under anyway, Thale said. If Janus reacts, we'll all have to deal with it.
We could use a little less speculation, Shrope said.
Right now, speculation's the only game in town, Thale shifted on his perch. Here's another thing, too. Whatever happens when we get to Janus, it isn't going to be the usual drill. We won't be running core samples or scouting out locations to attach a driver. So I assume that Parry's people are automatically the ones best suited to go crawling over the thing. The one thing we know about Janus is that it isn't a comet. Parry started to interject, but Bella cut him off. Parry's people have the most experience at EVA, she said.
But there isn't a person on this ship who hasn't been trained in basic suit functions, Thale said.
Face it, we'll be dealing with an environment completely unfamiliar to all of us. It seems to me that we'll be making a terrible mistake if we don't make maximum use of our scientists.
By putting them in suits, you mean? Bella asked.
I'm just saying I don't think it should be a foregone conclusion who gets to wear those suits.
It isn't, Bella said, and nor is it a foregone conclusion that there'll even be surface operations. Maybe once we get a close look at this thing, I'll decide not to send people out at all.
What about robots? Asked Saul Regis. Do robots count as surface operations?
Saul, Bella said with a straight face, please don't tell me you want danger money for the robots now.
Regis answered in his usual borderline autistic monotone. I mean, we should all be on Parry's maximum rate of pay even if we only send robots into the vicinity of Janus. Robots are just as likely to provoke a hostile reaction as people.
Robots and people, for all I know, have crawled over Janus in the past. They didn't provoke any kind of reaction.
Janus was hiding then. It isn't now.
Maybe we'll all go on to danger money as soon as we look at Janus, Bella said, tired of arguing.
Or as soon as we dream about it. Maybe we should be on danger money now, just because we're debating the faint possibility of going there.
There was a chorus of objections, but she shouted them down. Svetlana, say your piece.
You've already heard it. There's no technical reason why we can't make this trip.
And your people?
The majority support the Janus operation.
Bella wasn't surprised. Svetlana's people were engineers, all with an interest in spacecraft design and propulsion. Of course, they wanted a close look at Janus.
And you?
Bella watched a flicker of uncertainty cross Svetlana's face, as if she had made up her mind, but had just been stricken by renewed doubts.
Yes, she said tentatively. I think we should go, despite all the risks.
And you're still happy about the engine output and the stress loading?
I can't guarantee anything, Svetlana said. All I can give you is probability.
Spoken like a true engineer, Bella said resignedly.
Thank you. And the balance of probabilities is that the ship will hold together, although they may have to scrap it when we get back home.
That's somebody else's problem, Bella said.
All right. Anything else to add?
I'd like to check the numbers on the fuel.
Absolutely. I'd insist on it. Bella turned to face Ash Murray, the head of EVA technical support. He wore a denim shirt open over a yellow T-shirt, printed with the ship's drilling penguin mascot. Murray's team was the smallest on the ship, but one of the most essential.
You want to go crawling over a Janus? We'll supply the fucked-up Orlan 19s, Murray said, looking pointedly at Parry Boyce.
Bella nodded, knowing that was as close to a yes as she was going to get. That left Axford and his medical team.
Ryan, she said pleasantly.
Axford was a man she liked and trusted. We've talked already, and I think I know where you stand. Have you changed your mind?
I have a sick man in my care whose best hope of survival is to get back to Earth as quickly as possible, Axford said. Since you can't turn the ship around, and since Deep Shaft won't send out an unscheduled shuttle, Janus represents his best hope.
Is that what you told him?
I don't pull any punches, Axford said.
I don't think he's any happier than I am about nosing around near that thing, but he recognizes the lesser of two evils when he sees it.
Then you'd vote against the mission if Jim wasn't ill?
I'm voting to safeguard my patient's life. You have my word that the people under me feel the same way.
I'll see that we don't let Jim down, she said, or any of your team, for that matter. We have leverage now. It's too late to send out a shuttle,
but they can damn well send one to meet us on the way home.
You'll guarantee that?
Yes, she said.
Then you have my consent to take us to Janus.
That was Axford done. He would shrink back into the scenery now, just the way he had been before she talked to him, listening intently, but with a distracted, faraway look that suggested, quite wrongly as it happened, extreme inattention. With Ryan's vote in, it was clear that Janus had won the day, though not by an overwhelming majority. In Bella's estimation, some 60% of the crew were in favor of the mission, subject to haggling over bonus pay and working arrangements near the moon. 20% were unenthusiastic, but would go along with it. The other 20% were strongly opposed, irrespective of the bonus terms. Bella would have preferred a stronger majority, but at least the ship wasn't split down the middle, and she knew exactly how she felt. Janus was an unprecedented opportunity, not only for her crew, not only for her company, but for humanity as a whole. She'd believed that before she entered the room, and she believed it now. She held up her flexi, showing the tally of poll results to the assembled chiefs. "Back to your teams, people," she said, "and tell them to start battening down the hatches." When Rockhopper pulled away from the comet 4 hours later, a robot had already dropped the fragmentation assistance device into the shaft that Parry had dug to take the mass driver. The nuclear device was military surplus, recycled from the decommissioned warhead of a 40-year-old NATO surplus Bush 3 MIRV. It had been dialed to its maximum civilian yield of 10 megatons. The comet went up nicely. That was one piece of ice no one else would be getting their hands on.